Okay, my name is Andrew O'Connor. I'm a community radio producer and a freelance producer with CBC Radio. And I wanted to start the panel off just by getting each of the panelists to tell me about their experience making radio, both on-site and off-site. Let's start with Mark.
Okay. I'm Trademark G, and I'm when I'm not doing performances about golden records in space, one of the things I do is I run a radio station in the middle of the desert, and if that sounds rather isolated or lonely, it's not. I have tens of thousands of listeners and an international stable of DJs. The reason why is because it happens at the Burning Man Festival. This happens in the middle of the desert with in the Black Rock Desert of Nevada. And it happens every year for 1 week. And last year there was 48,000 people that showed up to this. So I'm sure we'll be cracking 50 this year. The Black Rock Desert is a completely harsh, dusty, windy, unrelenting, not very compatible with radio stations place to be. It also, the Burning Man's Festival itself is a pretty unusual place with a leave no trace policy, meaning that everyone must pack out everything they pack in, including trash, including everything. There's also no commerce that happens. Nothing is for sale in there except for ice and coffee. They do not sell water. But nonetheless, the otherworldly setting for it produces an unforgettable event. And the radio station has been unforgettable as well. It's called BMIR, and the BM stands for Burning Man. And the information used to stand for information, but we've been trying to get away from that. The reason why is because we're there as a sort of emergency radio station. You can imagine with 50,000 people in the desert, if something happens, there's not much of a way to get them to know about it. Radio is about the only way. It's there for emergencies. So I'll give you an example. One year, the Hurricane Katrina hit during the festival. And so we found ourselves in the unenviable task of having to inform whatever people that were there from New Orleans that they may not have a home to go back to. And the only way that we could possibly get that word out with some actual accurate information was our radio station. On more regular notes, things like weather emergencies are very common out there. 70-mile-an-hour winds happened multiple days out there last year. So there's many reasons that we really need to have some good instant way to communicate with a large bunch of people, and that's it. That said, though, we've been trying to go far beyond our utility role and grow to a more creative one. So as we've gone through the years, our facilities have grown from one shack to including a really deluxe refrigerated shipping container that's been converted into our studio. We broadcast with a 30-foot tower and power provided, and we have it pretty good there. Well, maybe I should make that the medium answer and go on, although I could, I definitely have plenty more to talk about to give you the back.
Shall we'll make
I
continue? Sure you get back to
it. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Let's move on to Gabe now. Gabe is, you're behind a project called Murmur, and you were saying earlier, before we started the panel, that you feel a bit like the odd man out here because, you really don't work in radio, but tell us about Murmur.
I really appreciate that that you all are stretching your definition of radio to include this project. I'm flattered. So Murmur is an audio project, site-specific audio documentary project, we call it, where we collect people's personal stories about the places in the city that are important to them. So we will interview people and do 2 to 3 minute, or edit them down in 2 to 3 minutes anyway. Interviews with people talking about a specific place, some place that they have some particular some particular connection to, and we all have these stories, and every place has these stories. The kinds of and I'm sure that all of you can think of there's some particular place when every time you walk by it always makes you remember a certain time, a certain event that happened or something. So these stories we think are, besides being difficult to share, we share them with our friends and family sometimes. Your like nephew comes to town and you walk around and, you know, tell him some weird, funny, historical, whatever stories about the places around you. You know, everything from like this place has really bad coffee to, you know, this building was designed in, you know, was built in 1943 and whatever else. So, the intent being to share stories, but also to hear each other's voices, and especially, you know, in the way that the in the city, there are a lot of people whose stories we will never hear, and to try to help capture some of those and help retain, in a sense, the cultural importance and stories about a place, even while the buildings may come and go, while stores and restaurants and other you know, important cultural places for people come and go, especially in a city like Toronto that's had so many waves of migration, a certain neighborhood will have like a really dramatic change in its identity and in people's understanding of it over the course of just a generation or two. So. That's the intent. I haven't described how it works yet. There are around the city a bunch of signs about yay high that are attached to telephone poles, and they look like a big green ear, funny ear shape, and they all have a telephone number on them. And when you see one of these signs, you can, if you have a mobile phone on you, or you can write down the number and call it from home. But call the phone number on the sign, and each sign has a different location code. Punch in the location code, and then you'll hear these stories. Hear people tell in the first person personal stories about why this place, the place where you're standing, has some significance to them. And then you're given the opportunity to leave your own story as well. We have now something like between 150 and 200 signs in Toronto, and we've launched the project in 7 other cities. Around the world, North America, Europe, and South America. I guess I'll leave it there. Is that, yeah, I'll
sure,
leave it there.
Sure, that's fine. We'll move on to Peter now.
All right, hello. I'm Peter Cordemanche, and I started doing noise art on campus radio in Vancouver in late 1987. And a couple of years after that, I was approached by Hank Bull, who wanted to enlist my aid in creating a telecom experiment connecting 4 radio stations together. And we hooked up with a radio station in Banff, which has since kind of evolved into a much larger thing. And a couple of stations that, one was in Calgary and one in Winnipeg, they were community radio stations that no longer exist. And managed to do a 1-hour simulcast, but hooking up all these stations where each participant played a role in some kind of weird nonlinear narrative that Hank created. She's very good at. And after that, I started getting interested in the idea of the possibility of extending radio out of the kind of single venue and into networks. And so my many years following that, I've kind of worked with telecommunications art as well as radio, and also with the birth of the internet in the early 90s, kind of connecting multiple venues together through the internet to do radio as well. And following that, I kind of approached by Heidi Grundmann, who's the founder of Kunstradio in Vienna, which some of you may have heard of. And she's been very interested for many years in the idea of projects that have multiple components that she calls on-air, online, on-site. So they have a radio show component, that's the on-air. They have a web presence, which is the on-site, which can be both an elaborate website and also the streaming of different events. So that's the online. And then the on-site can be a physical installation or performance piece, and there's been some fairly extravagant work done in that realm. So I've worked on a number of projects with them in that area as well. And then more recently I've been working on a large network that hooks a lot of venues together for an event called Art's Birthday, which was first coined by Fluxus artist Robert Filliou. In 1963, he invented this idea that art had a birthday 1 million years ago, 1 million years before 1963. He was very into mathematics, too. And in 1973, he actually staged two simultaneous celebrations, one in Aachen, Germany, at a gallery, and the mayor of Aachen actually, how am I pronouncing that right? Anyways, actually pronounced it a civic holiday, and they had bands marching in the street and all this activity around the celebration of Art's birthday, and they had a huge cake that for you, there's a good picture of him cutting the cake. And then also in, I can't remember which district, one of the districts outside of Paris anyways, quite close to Paris, had a big celebration and everybody came out into the streets at noon and had this huge party in the streets around Art's birthday. Robert Filliou died in late 1987, and so this actual radio show that I did with Hank Bull in 89 was one of the first kind of re-celebrations of Art's birthday as a new thing and involving telecommunications technology. And so I've been doing that for many years. So as this panel progresses, I'll talk a bit more about various types of networked radio art and how that's perceived, at least by me.
Okay. Now, I wanted to move on to, discussing the responsibilities that you have when moving out of the standard studio in a standard radio station. And Mark, you touched on that a bit earlier with Burning Man Radio, and that just for the location and where you are, there was a certain amount of, it had to serve a certain purpose.
Right. There's a definite utility. Like, there's a definite, chartered reason why we have to be there. But there's definitely, like, that community, as I've described, here we are at this, there's this community of 40,000 odd kind of, artistic, freaky partiers or whatever, that are all in this very isolated place. So we have this very sort of insulated, sort of captive audience. It's sort of a captive community in a way. And this gives us like a bunch of things that we could do that just never could happen. Just to give you one example, like I did this project for a while where I took a bunch of old tape recorders and just put fresh cassettes and batteries in them. And I painted instructions on them to just record something and pass it on. Now, I mean, if you did that here, how many of those would come back? Good luck to you. Zero, if not less, or somehow. But there, more than half of them come back. And they come back with full tapes full of people's stories and whatever else that is collected on them. In a way, kind of like Murmur, in a way, that gives people a chance to sort of share these stories that they've had of this space or this time or whatever. And so some of those have gotten broadcast out on the radio as, this is a way that that these stories make it out. I call the project the Automated Hobo Project because the cassettes are sort of these automatons that go around collecting stories of their travels. So that's just one example.
Okay. Yeah. Gabe, do you have anything to?
I'll reframe the question a little bit to fit this answer in. In our case, we're not. Both the people who are collecting the stories and the people who are contributing the stories are volunteers, and so our sort of biggest job in a way is to respect them and their time and their contribution to the project, and subsequently their contribution to all of us. We try to do that by being very careful and very respectful of the way that we use the stories, the way that we edit the stories if we need to do that, a check in with them as much as possible while we're working on the process. It makes it very labor intensive, but without a big budget, it's the only way to do it. I have more stuff to say, but I'm going to wait for so I'm not like twisting the question too much.
Okay, all right. Do you have anything to add to that, Peter?
Oh, sure. What?
Well, I was asking about the responsibilities of when you move outside of the standard studio setting in a standard radio station. What does that add? What do you feel you need to add to the performance or broadcast to represent that?
Well, I guess in the work that I do, that would be most easiest to understand would be installation work in a physical space that then also connects to a radio show, which is a fairly abstract thing. But one of the pieces I worked on called Devolve Into 2 was exactly that. We had an installation space with a big screen at one end and a whole pile of webcams that were commissioned 9 artists to sit in their studios at home all over the world and send us webcam information and with sound attached. And so this gets projected into the space and the sound gets remixed. And in the installation space had a 32-channel sound system, so we actually had a lot of stuff to play with. And then out of this, we were expected to create radio shows. So both pre-recorded material that would be played at a later date and live radio. So from the live radio perspective, the easiest thing to do is to bring, there were like 4 or 5 people who were close enough to the installation space that they could kind of drive down there. And we kind of got this ensemble together that sits in the installation space and works with the sounds that are coming in and mixes it and then makes that available as a live radio show. So it's kind of an interesting context. And then using the network, it just enables you to connect to someone way far away and bring in their bit of sound and, you know, play with it in an interesting way.
Now, I know from my own experiences working radio, when you move outside of the studio is a very controlled environment, dead sound, and once you move outside of that, it sort of introduces an element of chaos, an element of the unpredictable into what you do. Do you guys feel the need to have that present when you're making radio outside of that?
Sorry, I'm busting up laughing here because you're describing this beautiful, pristine, sterile environment, and I'm just thinking about the dust-laden shacks of studios in refurbished meat-containing shipping containers that we have set up in. I mean, it's just ridiculous trying to think of it in those terms. If there's one big drawback to what we're doing, it is just the harsh environment that we're doing it in. I mean, last year we had days of complete whiteouts and brownouts due to dust storms and high winds that were just causing sand dunes to develop up against our studio buildings. I mean, you know, if you try to imagine like what shape our equipment is in, you think about that for a while. You know, you'll understand why we have backups of every single thing that we bring out there. So we're basically bringing 2 radio stations out there every time. So that's talk about the rigors of the environment. Well, yes, I can definitely I have stories.
And Gabe, your project is meant to be heard along with all the sounds that are going on, right? You see the number, you call your cell phone. So I'm wondering if that is a part of what you do with Murmur.
Yeah, I mean we came at this completely without a background in audio recording or anything like that. Consequently, our initial recordings sounded like garbage. That's okay though, because phones sound even worse. So no one notices how bad they sound. In some cases, you do, and we're slowly kind of wrapping our heads around how to do that, and then finding ways of passing that little bit of knowledge we have onto our volunteers who are also collecting stories. But it is really important for us to, whenever possible, do the recordings on site because there are a lot of subtleties that can be lost if you're not, a lot of subtleties in the way that stories are told that can be lost if you're not doing it on site. In particular, we're really trying to convey, to, in a way, help craft the stories into something that is going to be easily understandable by the listener. What that means is, in order to really convey that best, I mean, you want to, as much as possible, have it be like the experience of standing next to someone who is telling you the story. And when someone's standing next to you telling you the story, they won't say, you know, at the corner of Spadina and Dundas, there's this one building that, and there's this thing that happened in that building. They're more likely going to say, like, hey, in that red building over there on the 4th floor, 2nd window from the right, that was my apartment, and here's where this thing took place. And by having that, by making that physical connection, that visual connection to a specific spot, it makes the story come that much more alive. And so you cannot do that if you're not in the place, unless you're with someone who really gets it and knows exactly how to fake it, which is not common. So we do as much as possible want to record on site, but like try to record audio at Spadina and Dundas, like it's not going to turn out well. So it's been a thing for us to try to find ways of working with the storytellers and the volunteers, and coming up with techniques that help us still squeeze those kinds of details into the story when we can't record on site.
Okay. Well, I guess I tend to actually work in pretty nice environments, and even doing on-site work. So I'd say what I've been interested in radio is not so much going to the adverse location to create radio, but to bring adversity into the studio. And certainly when you're doing like noise art live on air in the studio, your first thing you do is you open the door and you start running tape loops down the hall and you're picking up all kinds of noises from all over the place. And actually, you know, pulling all this kind of weirdness out of the so-called sterile studio, which, you know, usually has a lot of nonsense going on in it and noises all over the place anyways. And the same in installation spaces. I like to do site-specific work, so you know, you go in and you check out the room, you figure out what cool things are there, what interesting sounds might be there, and to play with that kind of stuff in the mix.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious how much thought is given to the listener in the process of this, and where it will be broadcast, or if it will be broadcast, in the creation process and in the production of this. Are you thinking about who is going to hear this and how they're going to experience it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, well, for us, we're face to face with the listeners very often. One of the other parts of what we do regularly is that a lot of people at the Burning Man Festival will be involved with certain theme camps, and they'll have activities or public events going on. And so we let them come in and record promos for their events and for their camps. But it doesn't have to be about a specific event or whatever. They can come in and record a promo about anything. So if they just want to, you know, proclaim the glory of love to the rest of the festival, we'll let them do that if they want. And so we've ended up with some very interesting things that come, you know, directly from the listeners, quite literally. And then sometimes, a lot of the on-air staff or the DJs have to be ready for just about anything to roll their way, because a lot of people will just kind of walk into the on-air studio and not realize they're going into the wrong building or whatever, and be like, hey, can I be on the air? And, you know, a DJ had better be either ready to put them on the air or at least deal with them properly. But being so, very closely involved with our listeners gives us a lot of chance to really kind of cater to them in really unusual ways. One example is that I was approached by the group that drummers, and it's this mass group of drummers that when the culmination of the event is that this man, this stick figure man in the middle of the festival, gets burned down to the ground. And so they have all these drummers around it. I mean, it's dozens, if not 100 or more drummers. And so he had the idea of broadcasting a click track so we could actually get everyone in sync. So we could, you know, all these people could actually just tune in. You know, they could be wearing earbuds or whatever, or listening to the radio to this drum track going, and everyone would be in sync. So.
And did it work? Were they in sync?
We haven't done it yet. This is upcoming, so okay. I can't wait to see if it works.
now, Gabe, I would imagine you really don't have much of any contact with the people who call these murmur sites.
We don't know who they are. We know when they call and which signs they're calling and stuff like that. But I don't know anything about these people. Though, I mean, is that so different from radio? I don't know.
That's a good question. Is that so different than radio?
Anyway. But we do. I mean, certainly. Probably like in radio, have an idea in our head of who they are and what they're like and how we need to design this experience to work well for them. And So far, it seems like we're not that far off. I mean, so far it seems like it's worked out pretty well. I mean, we do we spend a lot of time thinking about what I guess maybe I don't know in that in you know new media art and design we call user experience design, where you know we're trying to like take good practices towards making it an experience that's easy to understand, because if there are no listeners of this thing, then it makes it hard to motivate ourselves to continue. So we've done pretty well in that respect. I mean, if it means that we have sacrificed the free and openness or like, you know, of the project in the sense that we are very particular about how we want the stories to be told, and that we edit them, and that we don't include all the submissions that we get, then it is because we want to make sure that it's a good experience for listeners.
In response to the question about whether or not it's different in radio, I know for myself, having worked in a couple of different fields of radio, and when I work for the CBC, it's more I do have to have the listener in mind. I do have to keep the show that it's going to be on in mind, and make something that's going to fit in that context. But in my community radio experience, I have had the freedom to just do whatever it is I want to do. And it's something I wanted to discuss is that sort of that tension between the two and whether, I guess that tension between the two and how much you want the listener to know what you're thinking and how much you want to accommodate the listener and what you're creating.
Well, I guess especially in the noisier stuff that I do, it's fairly antisocial in a way and in its history. And it's kind of like doing radio for an audience of one, and in a way that, I mean that in the way that there are a number of very interesting writers who say that when they're writing work, they write it for an audience of one, which is themselves. And that way, if they start worrying about who's reading it and trying to modify the stuff to suit who's reading it, then they don't produce good work. And so when I say I produce work for an audience of one, I don't mean that I don't want anybody else to hear it or I want to drive everyone away, but I don't actually worry too much about the audience in that way. And then I find I put it out there and I get all kinds of interesting comments back of, you know, and people seem to like that style. So in I guess after getting the feedback, it says, okay, that approach is working in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm wondering sort of the lines between, I mean, we're talking about making radio here, but, I mean, you obviously don't make radio, and it's, I'm wondering sort of the line that each one of you would draw between when it's a piece of radio, when it is a piece of music, when it is a piece of media art. Or is there even a line that you draw?
Yeah, for ourselves, it's fairly clear because the DJs that come in kind of bring their own show in, and for the most part, they don't get too too adventurous, I guess, in a way. Well, that's not really the right way to put it. They certainly get adventurous, but I guess in terms of like coming up with a really unique like radio art experience, because just, you know, making it through the dust storms and actually straggling into the studio is a pretty good accomplishment in and of itself. And if your iPod still works, well, that's even better. So there's not really a lot that goes on that, you know, is much beyond the typical DJ show. But having said that, we do pre-record a number of things that that definitely try to play with things. Like to bring up one example, a couple of years ago, there was a theme of the Burning Man Festival, which was hope and fear. And so we played on the hope and fear theme, and we pre-recorded a number of segments, which sounded like news reports that were just complete fabrications. They were, you know, misinformation, which is great since we're supposed to be the source of information that's reliable. So we broadcast this misinformation that were either from these two alternate futures. One was this future of hope, where things are just going great, and you know, the people, Burning Man is sprouting forth Nobel winners and, you know, all sorts of greatness. And then a future of fear, where everyone at Burning Man is getting arrested, or where the people who started it have been shut down by the DEA, or things like that. So in those ways, we're definitely, well, there you go, I think.
So, I mean, for me, I don't really, those distinctions don't mean a whole lot to me. I mean, when I'm working on stuff, it tends to be about creating experiences. And so, for example, when we decided that we wanted to work on something that would help people share their stories about the city, we spent a lot of time thinking about how we might do that, and considered like a billion different technologies and systems and methods, and we ended up with what we've got with cell phones and signs, because that just seemed like the way that would be kind of easiest to pull off, like the right balance between like easy, cheap, and maybe we'll be able to keep doing this for a few years before we get tired of it. That's great, because even though, you know, like there's like mobile technology and wireless and yada yada, if we were starting this, the project is 5 years old this summer, and if we were starting it now, we would build it in pretty much entirely the same way, which I think is like, you know, means that, hey, we lucked out with the decisions that we made 5 years ago. And also is like kind of a bit disappointing in the context of, well, it wasn't, you know, shouldn't there be other options now for how to, in terms of like mobile technology, for how to build something like this? And maybe at the same time, I kind of want to plug another project that I work on, which is called, which sort of extends out of what I was just saying, but it's a community group called Wireless Toronto. That we call it a community wireless network, and it's an all volunteer group that sets up free wireless internet hotspots in public places and publicly accessible places in the city, following the model of a lot of similar groups like that in other cities. I came into that being interested in that because not as like a techie or an activist, which I am. Consider myself both, but really as an artist or a content creator who wanted to work with, who's really interested in media and place, and recognizing that, you know, Murmur is great. It's really great at one thing, and there are a couple of other things that I'd like to work on that it doesn't quite fit for. And so with each of these free internet hotspots that Wireless Toronto sets up, there is a the first webpage that you hit when you log into the network is one that has information about where you are, what's going on here, what's the history of this place, what events are going on, just what is this place about? And in a way, reconnecting that idea, reconnecting people who, you just get this idea of like, people go to the cafe and open their laptop and then they completely zone out from everything that's physically around them and they're just, you know, connected to the machine. So giving that sort of opportunity to through the machine to reconnect back to the physical place and to the people and the, you know, whatever else is around. So in that respect, I mean, I definitely work in technology and with computer-based technology, but the distinctions some distinctions that do matter, but my focus is really very much on how, you know, who's the audience and how to reach them in order to help facilitate certain experiences.
Okay, and Peter, I'm curious of your sort of views on this, because I mean your performance Friday night involved transmission and radios, but were you making radio on site? Do you view it that way?
I guess you could view part of the piece as radio on site. Anna Frizz was broadcasting to these receivers that are hanging from the ceiling, which I don't know, would fit the definition of radio on site. I don't know. I mean, in terms of the distinction of, radio, media art, and all these different genres, I tend to take more of an interdisciplinary approach to it, and I, you know, like to mix things up as much as possible and see what comes out. So I don't really worry too much about
the
distinctions, as long as there's someone there who's interested to hear it and a way for it to get out there.
Okay. You were mentioning, Gabe, a lot of the things you just said there when you were talking about how it's not really radio and you don't define it as radio are things that I think about when I'm making radio. Is this going to be compelling to the storyteller? Is this, how do I take this story that somebody's told me and make it something where you're still staying true to the to what they told you, but putting it in a format that isn't 10 minutes long and has a bunch of things that mean nothing to nobody, right? Yeah. So is, do you try and take it from that perspective, or?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I mean, I think that one thing that we do have in our, whatever, that makes it easier for us to do that is that at least we can assume, we could design the experience so that we know where that person is standing, right, when they're listening to it. And there's something that's really, that's compelling about that. That you know, there's an opportunity there for us to try to take advantage of that knowledge and customize it just to try to make it a richer experience. So yeah, definitely. I mean, we try pretty hard to come up with a methodology or formula or something for doing this, doing these interviews and making these recordings and doing the editing and crafting this in a way that that will try to take best advantage of that like very bizarre and particular opportunity that we have to communicate with these people.
Now that sounds a lot like like Burning Man Radio, does it not?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not sure how to answer that.
Well, you're doing an internet thing now, isn't it? So how is the audience different?
Well, we're spinning off. The one thing that a persistent complaint that we would always have going to Burning Man was that this is great, but we only get to do it 1 week a year. How can we do it the 51 weeks for the rest of the year? And so we're starting to spin off now that's called Shouting Fire. And so Shouting Fire is an internet radio spinoff. But we're taking it, it's obviously a very different animal now because, you know, we're no longer, you know, this is what we do when we're not at Burning Man. And so obviously there's a much different feel of doing this than when we're actually there in the middle of the gritty desert. That said, though, it's a really great community that we've built up at the desert, and it's great to bring that off desert and see what we can do when we're not, you know, kind of with our hands tied behind our back in a dust storm. So, this is just launching now, and so I don't really have a good feel for what to say about it yet. But I think I got a good feeling in my stomach about it.
And I'm curious as to the difference because obviously it's happening in a completely different setting. So then, how does that turn around and affect the content?
Especially in terms of that the DJs are not all together, and so the DJs are doing it individually from their homes or from someone's studio or whatever, and sending in their shows. And so this means that even though, you know, we're still trying to maintain our international DJs, and so we have shows coming in from Montreal and from New York and from Portland and from San Francisco, and so they all get coordinated into what becomes Shouting Fire. So it feels a little bit more disconnected because everyone's remote and everyone's just sort of, in a sense, they're sort of podcasting their show in. But that said, I mean, when I listen to it, I get that little that feeling of nostalgia or whatever when I listen to it because it has enough to remind me of like, oh yeah, there's Patty with Patty Schmidt with her show again. You know, boy, I haven't seen her since the Playa. I can't wait to hear what she's playing. So yeah.
And now, Gabe, with moving Murmur into different countries, like you were saying, how does that affect the content and the delivery and?
Good question. I guess in a way we hoped that it wouldn't. I mean, not at a high level. I mean, we tried to design the system, the method, the process to be pretty transportable. Whenever we do from one city to the next, from one neighborhood to the next, almost from one street to the next, the project changes. And based on who we're working with in the city and the interests of the volunteers, all of those things affect how the project turns out. But overall, our approach to it tends to be the same. At a high level, it's in all the details, right? It's in the way that as an example, when we did the project in Montreal, this was almost 5 years ago now. We were working with some I think radio folks there actually, and the stories that they recorded in Montreal sound completely different than any of the stories from any other city besides being in French. The storytellers are clearly they sound much more like performances, like they've been maybe written, but certainly rehearsed, and they're not what we asked for, but they're wonderful. And some of my favorite stories are those ones because of the way that there's really much more of that that craft of storytelling there, as opposed to the stories that we tend to record in other cities, and the approach that we normally take to recording stories, which is much more casual, much more spontaneous, with a lot more pauses and ums and changes of direction and stuff like that.
Yeah. You know, Gabe, as you're describing that, it's really reminding me of the tape recorder project that I mentioned earlier, because there's a certain, you know, in this project, we pass out tape recorders, and so we get just unrehearsed people just grabbing it, pressing record, and saying the first thing that comes to their mind, which is very much like the people that call up Murmur. And I can definitely attest that there's a certain sort of, like, authenticity and a certain sort of immediacy to those people's statements or stories or whatever that is really lost with some of the pre-recorded things, or even the people that walk in off the street with a prepared thing that they do want to say. There's a certain honesty that I really respect with those recordings.
Now, Peter, I know just by nature of what you work with, I imagine a lot of it is different every time you do it, right? And I'm curious how much the place it's happening has an effect on what you do.
Well, that's a good thing to talk about. The piece that we performed here, I use VLF antennas, very low frequency antennas, and they pick up radiation from the space. And so the first time we did the piece, we were in a very noisy, radio noisy place, and it was easy to pick up all kinds of stuff. And then we came into this building, which has all these huge thick cement walls and apparently various kinds of shielding in the walls as well, and it's very radio silent. So then it's a matter of trying to figure out, well, what does work in the space, and where can you kind of find the little things that you need out of a particular spot, which in this space is quite interesting. It all had to be kind of like below 2 feet above the floor, and if I got up too high, these particular speakers obviously radiate a massive amount of magnetic field along with the sound, because they feed back with the magnetic coils like really, really fast. And so there's interesting things like that, yeah, that you discover in each new space. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we're ready for questions here, if anybody has any. Oh, looks like we got one.
I'm curious, several things you said, you mentioned that there are some kinds of stories that people give you that you don't use. And I'm wondering, does that fall into certain categories of stories, or you don't want people swearing, or what kind of filters do you use and why?
There are certain things that we exclude, and then there are certain things that we're looking for. So we exclude anything that's like illegal or going to get us in legal trouble. Though we'll stretch that when we feel like we need to, like we want to, and mostly what we're looking for are stories that that are going to enrich the listener's understanding of the place. That's going to add something to what they know about this place. That's something that they might, ideally a kind of story that they might the next time they're walking by, tell their friend that they're walking along with. They say, oh, hey, I heard this story about this place, and there's this thing that happened here 25 years ago. The stories also have to be personal. So people may want to tell us, you know, that they're a historian or something like that, and they would really love to leave a story about the history of this building and who designed it and when it was designed and who the first tenant was and all of that stuff. And if that's all that they're giving us, we won't include the story because we demand that there be a personal aspect to it. If you're going to tell us a story about the history of this building, tell us also why is it important to you. Frame it with something that's about you. And then as well, there needs to be a very clear reason for that story to be in this place. It needs to be clear to the listener, why is it that this story is here and not down the block or somewhere else in the city. So that's basically it. I mean, if we... If it's going to provide that experience and then fits those couple of categories, we'll do it. I mean, so that excludes the, like, oh my God, I got so drunk one night and whatever. Like, those kinds of stories, it's not that we don't want them, it's that they don't fit our criteria, you know? We also don't want them, but they don't fit our criteria, and so that's why we don't include them.
Actually, I have a question that I'd like to pose to everyone. I just wanted to ask everyone here what rewards you've gotten from your projects that were unexpected. What was it that when you set out, you know, you never expected that you were going to get this benefit?
Well, I can speak personally just from just to start the discussion here. Working, just doing stories, little documentary pieces for CBC Radio, there's always that moment when you still have the tape player running and you're not really paying attention and you record something and then you get back in the studio and you think, oh, I got to use that. And it's never what you asked. It's never what you were looking for. But there's just always those, almost every story, there's always that 5-second clip that just makes the whole story. Yeah. For me personally, I don't know. Right. I imagine Gabe, there's the...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because in a way, you said that 5-second thing isn't what you were looking for. It's not what you asked, but it's the thing that it was the sort of goal that you came away with. And in our case, it's almost the opposite, where we're looking for personal stories and we're looking for people to really to share something that they don't often share, something that they aren't often given the opportunity to share. And what ends up happening is, you know, we sit down or we stand or whatever it is and we record and they tell us this, you know, this very nice story about, you know, something that happened when they were a kid. And then they finish and great, okay. And then we've learned not to hit stop because, 5 or 10 seconds will pass and then the real story will come out. And this is maybe something that you guys experience all the time, if those of you who do interviews, but it was really... It happened so many times that you go like this, you go, and make it look like you pushed off, but you don't do it because the goal is about to come out. And that's the thing that we were looking for, right? The thing that we were looking for was the personal story, was something interesting, maybe something a little bit, something that they wouldn't tell their mom or whatever, but the story that's really the one that they wanted to share, and they weren't sure if it was okay or not, and so they do it after having told the okay version or the conventional version of the story.
It reminds me of a friend of mine who works in commercial radio doing news and stuff, and he often has to do sort of phone-in interviews with people about some event that they've seen, and he will press record as soon as they pick up, record everything, then do the interview, and then say, oh, by the way, I was recording that, because you get... better when people are just talking to you. You're going to get something a lot better than when they're answering a formal question. And I often find when I'm interviewing people, they'll sort of go off on a tangent and say, oh, sorry, I'm not answering your question. And it's like, no, just go. Just go. I'm recording. Just go. Good. Any other questions from...
Do you want to answer your own question?
Yeah, answer your own question. Sure.
Yeah, I'll answer my own question. What unexpected benefits? The probably... Well, there are things like we've had pizzas delivered to the station in the middle of the desert where there's no ovens. One from Pizza Sluts and the other from Pizza Smut. We've had just innumerable kind of things like that, and I could go on and on about those. But I think really the most unexpected thing is we actually have a really good radio station running that sounds really good. And when I listen back to the archives, I'm really impressed that a bunch of dirty people in the desert with a bunch of dusty crap can actually make it sound that good. It's really pretty incredible.
Okay, unless there's any other questions, I think that just about does it. All right, thank you.